Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Michael Kleichstead and I'll be joined by a slew of hosts tonight who I will not introduce. The goal of tonight's show is to discuss the complexities involved in the International Criminal Court's attempt to arrest the President of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, and to discuss the importance of an upcoming UN meeting on Friday the 24th. To do that, we have a very special guest, Jennifer Shenzi, who is the International Cooperation Advisor in the Office of the Prosecutor at the ICC, and she happens to be a specialist on Darfur. So thank you for joining us, Jennifer.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This is a little bit off topic, so I'm just going to get it out of the way now. I'm pretty sure that one of the hyenas in the movie The Lion King is named Shenzi. So I've got to ask you, what's the history behind that name? I mean, is it Swahili? What is it?
No, actually, it is of German origin, but a while ago. I'm American.
Okay, so nothing to do with The Lion King. I need to just give that up.
No. There is a character called Shenzi in The Lion King, but we're not related.
See, I'm glad you agree, because everyone was looking at me like I was crazy, but I knew I had everybody. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, can you briefly describe for us what you do at the ICC?
Well, I'd be glad to. I work in the Office of the Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and in particular in a division which is called the Jurisdiction, Complementarity, and Cooperation Division, which is kind of a mouthful. But what it means is that we work on a number of issues in relation to investigations, including cooperation. So working with states, NGOs, the United Nations, regional organizations like the African Union and the Arab League to secure cooperation in our work.
So in like layman's terms, and this is kind of what I'm getting, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, you're sort of like a referee, liaison, make sure people play nice together sort of thing?
I might describe it more as being a diplomat for the court, for the Office of the Prosecutor, making our work known and engaging with key actors with whom we need to interact in order to carry out our work successfully.
Gotcha.
And you would be operating with countries that were outside that hadn't signed the Rome Statute or ratified it?
Well, in fact, we have contact with both state parties, that's states that have ratified, and with non-state parties. So we have contact with many states.
Very cool. How did you become interested in the ICC?
Well, you know, when I was in law school, I was studying human rights. And by the time I finished law school, the United Nations Security Council was just setting up the ad hoc tribunals for Rwanda and for Yugoslavia. So this was part of my experience learning about these institutions. I went into work for the NGO community, in particular for the Coalition for the International Criminal Court, and that's really how I got involved with the work.
So you decided you want to grow up to be a member of the ICC advisors, the prosecutor's office?
Well, it was a sort of natural opportunity working for the coalition. I started with the coalition in 1998, and the court was set up in 2002 and changed the statute. So really I was lucky to be able to join the prosecutor's office in 2004 and to participate in its work.
And as I understand it, the Coalition for the International Criminal Court played a really formative role in the establishment of the court and also in the substantive law that we find in the Rome Statute. Is that correct?
Yeah, I found that to be the case. And it was one of a number of sort of NGO coalitions or movements. It was preceded in some way or parallel to the work, for example, of NGOs on the landmines movement, trying to ban landmines. Similar campaigns have taken place in relation to small arms and other issues around the United Nations. But from my experience, the coalition was quite effective in bringing independent external experts from the NGO world and the academic world and elsewhere into a process where they could feed their knowledge and have interaction with states that were trying to create a fair and independent international court.
And so you mentioned that when you were in law school, you had a human rights course. When you started law school, were you sort of planning this as a trajectory, or did you take human rights and you were totally became sort of bitten by the human rights bug and said, I have to do this?
Well, I have to say that I have found that the field is moving so fast in the development of the law, and not just the law, but of the institutions to monitor and to try to ensure compliance, that when I started law school, there was no way even to know that the International Criminal Court would exist when I finished law school, or that it would be somewhere I could work. So I think it is very in a very exciting field for international law students to contemplate, because where it's going to be in a few years' time when they can participate, you know, it's just something to watch even day by day as it develops.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I understand it, the court hasn't even completed its first case yet. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, the first years of the court, you have to keep in mind that when the prosecutor started, he had a handful of employees and interns, and the first few years has also been about building credible and effective institution, and an institution that can outlive his tenure for when the next prosecutor will be elected and the next one after that. So it has also been a process of establishing relations with states for whom the institution existed as a concept but not as an actual institution up until its establishment in 2002 and 2003. So from the very beginning, the office had contact with the government of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And in these discussions, the DRC decided to refer its situation to the ICC, which in fact in the negotiations is something that most states thought would never happen, that a state would refer its own situation to the ICC. So from the very beginning, you had really, you know, events unfolding that no one could have anticipated. But that process has preceded the investigation, for example, in Congo, which started in 2003. And when you conduct the investigation, you look at the situation as a whole in order to narrow down on specific cases. And then when you go from the crime base to the specific cases, you identify the specific individuals. So that process of identifying those individuals, conducting the investigations, ensuring their arrests, and then the trial process is also quite deliberate. So it takes a lot of time to create an institution that in the end will be quicker than it is at the start.
Sure. Yeah, we watch the film The Reckoning, and in that the court is referred to as a justice startup, and I think that's an apt description. And when I was at the court, I was sitting in on the Katanga trial, and another thing that takes so long is just the translation of a question. Like the prosecutor was asking a question in French, and then it had to be translated into a dialect of Swahili and then translated into English, and then the child had to understand what exactly was being asked. So even after you actually get the defendant in the court, you know, the actual trial itself is extra long because of the whole language issue. But
well, sometimes
on to,
it seems like every possible frontier you can push, we're trying to push. I mean, in one of the Darfur cases where we had the voluntary appearance of some members of the rebel movement who want to speak their language, which is not a written language, you know. So, there, you know, we would have a question, for example, how do you disclose a written document in the language that they prefer when the language is not written? So you can have all of these questions that come up.
Interesting dilemma that is.
Yeah, that's why, you know, going back to what you said, Jennifer, that it's just such a fascinating, interesting issue for law students now, because it's an emerging field of law and all this stuff is really, you know, being figured out now and being developed now. But moving on to the whole, we're focused on the Darfur issue, Sudan issue tonight, and we're just focused on the arrest warrant of the president, Omar al-Bashir. There are other individuals from the Sudan who have arrest warrants out for them as well, but to just keep things simple, we're focused on the arrest warrant of the president. And could you just briefly describe, I know that President al-Bashir is charged with various international crimes, and can you describe what they are?
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, he is charged with 10 counts of all three crimes, essentially, or all three categories of crimes in the Rome Statute, which are war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. And the statute does not differentiate in terms of the gravity of crimes. But, of course, there is a certain stigma that is attached to genocide, which, in fact, there are two arrest warrants for President al-Bashir, one issued in 2009 for crimes against humanity and war crimes, and the second recently, a few months ago, in 2010, for genocide. But, in fact, the the warrant for crimes against humanity included the crime of extermination as a crime against humanity, which is really a hair's breadth apart from genocide. So all of them are very serious crimes that he's been charged with.
Absolutely. Can you explain for us, we learned in our research, not just in watching The Reckoning, but in various documents we found, that the reaction from these crimes that al-Bashir has been charged with for the African Union has been collectively negative, in the sense that, I guess I'll just say it in my own thoughts rather than, you know, a formal statement. They didn't like it. They were against al-Bashir being charged, and they kind of felt as though, I guess, their territory was invaded. Could you explain that to us? I mean, why did the African Union respond in this way? What reason would they have for not wanting the International Criminal Court involved?
Well, in fact, you know, the International Criminal Court issued warrants for a senior member of the Sydney government in 2007 for Ahmad Haroon, who was Minister of State for the Interior and then Minister of State for Humanitarian Affairs, and reporting directly to Bashir. And the African Union was supportive of the ICC and didn't take any kind of negative position about Ahmad Haroon. So I think the question, and when you look at the decisions that the African Union has taken, it's not a question about the crimes, it's about President al-Bashir's position. And I think this poses a bigger question, and it's not just for contemplation by the African Union, but for the international community as a whole. How do you successfully confront someone who uses a position of high power to commit crimes? And that's, you have an extreme example with President al-Bashir, but in fact Ahmad Haroon is also very effective and continues to be effective in using power to organize and commit crimes against civilians. And this, I think, you see a kind of, you know, where we're talking about pushing frontiers, you see a kind of squeamishness on the political level with dealing with head of state crimes, with dealing with high-level official sanctioned crimes. But we still have the examples, of course, of Slobodan Milosevic and Charles Taylor as heads of state who were charged and ended up in the dock. And I think it's really a matter of time until sort of the political views can be reconciled with the judicial reality.
I just actually, wanted to read, just to address this argument or the disconcertment on behalf of the African Union. And this is a press release that they issued at the end of August. And in the press release, they're basically very critical of the UN Security Council, which referred the Darfur case to the International Criminal Court. We talked about that last week. And I just want to read from this and then, Jennifer, get your comments on it. They say, and again, this is a press release, the same UN Security Council, which has ignored this request by AU member states, that's African Union member states, and the request was to basically delay the proceedings against al-Bashir for a year. And they made this request to the UN Security Council. They ignored it. And there are member states of the UN Security Council that have no obligations to the International Criminal Court, the U.S. among them. And therefore, the UN Security Council has, and they use this phrase, moral authority to sit in judgment over Chad and Kenya. So before we get to the Chad and Kenya quagmire, just the first question that I have for you is, what is your response to that insofar as members of the UN Security Council, which are not members of the ICC, do refer this case to the ICC and then sit in judgment over al-Bashir and some other countries that we'll bring up soon?
Yeah, no, I'm familiar with the language. I do believe that the political discussion between the Security Council and the Union is something that they need to find a way to manage between themselves, and that's an ongoing process, even in a broader context of how the UN and the Security Council relates to regional organizations, which is an important question because they have a key role to play. But it really kind of distracts, in a way, some of the language from the key issue, which is that the Security Council as a whole has the mandate under Chapter 7 to address measures that they believe will help to strengthen international peace and security or address threats that or threats to international peace and security. In 1994, 1995, 1993, this period, they created ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia and for Rwanda. And when the ICC was created, the agreement among the states, and there were something like almost all of the international community negotiating the treaty, was that that Chapter 7 power would be reflected in the capacity of the Council to refer situations to the ICC. In fact, even the Council's power was a little bit watered down. It was not created as a court that only answers to the Security Council or is only mandated by the Council, but one to which the Council can turn. So the issue is not the obligation of a state to the ICC. In this case, it's the issue of the obligations of states to the United Nations Charter. And the Security Council makes decisions that create obligations for states. And in fact, all of these states are members of the UN Charter. So whether members of the Security Council are part of the ICC or not is not really relevant. I mean, they have created an obligation, and the African Union needs to have, I think, that discussion with the Security Council about how to manage the obligations as it's done.
Okay.
Just trying to paraphrase what was just said, because that was a lot of information, but I basically got the sense that, well, the issues not so much with the ICC and the African Union, but the UN and their jurisdiction with the amount, with the force that they bring in. Am I completely off on that?
Well, I mean, the Security Council, basically, it has a role to play with the ICC. In fact, when the Council makes a referral, it doesn't necessarily mean that the ICC or the Office of the Prosecutor will open an investigation. In fact, we need to ensure that all the legal criteria under the statute are met before we would open an investigation. But in terms of the Council's role, I think it's very clear under the UN Charter, under Chapter 7, and that's reflected in the Rome Statute. But how they use that power and how they engage with regional organizations is something that the Council needs to address. It's reflected a little bit on the ICC because the Council has engaged the ICC as a solution or part of the solution to try to change the behavior of the regime in the city. It's just about highlighting the fact that policies that direct attacks at civilians are undermining stability and threatening international peace and security.
And so Chapter 7, if you could just, so Chapter 7 in a nutshell says that, you know, the obligation is to protect the security and promote peace or something. What was the language that you used?
Chapter 7 of the UN Charter is about how the Council addresses threats to international peace and security.
Okay.
So this is their basic
threat. Can't one argue that becoming a member of the ICC is, like, necessary to actually fully fulfill that mandate?
I think we'll have to see in future years how the Council and the ICC relate. They're mandated in their relationship, and it's very carefully mandated or controlled by the provisions of the Rome Statute. But how it evolves is something that we'll have to see in the coming years.
Mm.
But in fact, the Office of the Prosecutor and the ICC has very fruitful contact and relations with non-state parties as well. In fact, state parties are obliged to cooperate, but there is an inherent dialogue in talking about cooperation and how it unfolds, and we have that dialogue as well with non-state parties. So it's up to states whether to ratify or not to ratify, but they can all play a role in helping the court to work effectively, and that's also part of mainstreaming this issue of how do you handle justice and impunity.
Okay.
Well, that transfers nicely into this question. From the research that we did, Al-Bashir has visited both Chad and Kenya, who have both signed the Rome Statute. So what is, a state's, I guess, responsibility to upholding what the ICC is doing, provided that they sign the statute? It's not like Al-Bashir was going over to Chad and meeting up with some shady people in some cave. He was rather meeting with the people of the state. And so... you would imagine that people who supported the Rome Statute and, I guess, are part of the state collective associated with the ICC would do something about that, or at least notify somebody. I was just wondering if you could explain what the role is of Chad or Kenya in such a situation.
Well, I mean, in fact, both Chad and Kenya have been incredibly cooperative and incredibly supportive of the investigations of the ICC. I mean, again, the issue of arrests and arrest strategy is kind of a frontier issue and one that takes a lot of creative thinking, and it also requires a lot of political will for states to move forward on. So I think it's also something that we're going to see more and more coherent policy on in the coming years. And Bashir, in a way, is the extreme example, because as a head of state, you know, it creates political problems for states that they have to learn to manage. But in fact, there was quite a backlash to Bashir's visit to Kenya, which I think will make it more difficult for a similar visit to take place in the future. And we continue to monitor his movements and to look at the best way for states to try to secure his arrest. So I think it's only a matter of time before he's in the Hague.
And also, Kenya is also under investigation by the ICC. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. An investigation
of the elections.
Well, we're looking at allegations of violence during the elections that would fit under the Rome Statute crimes, but also with an eye toward the coming elections in 2012, with the idea that if you address impunity, if you help to support accountability for the crimes in the past election, that you may be able to prevent the same and worse in the coming election.
So given that, on the one hand, you know, you want to address the violence from, I think it was the 2007 election in Kenya, with an eye to preventing it, and given that Kenya also is a member state and also has the potential to arrest the head of state of Sudan, I mean, this is like a very politically complex issue. So on the one hand, and last week we were talking about with Sudan, I believe at one point in the investigation of Uganda, Sudan agreed to basically help in the ICC in the investigation and apprehension of Joseph Kony. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. They have signed an agreement to that effect.
So you have, you know, these agreements and these dependencies on states, and Sudan is not a member state, correct? They just signed an agreement to help out in the case of Joseph Kony.
No, they're not a member state of the ICC.
Right. So you're depending on sort of, you know, the goodwill for them to come through in their agreements. In the case of Kenya, there's the investigation. So I would just like the listeners to appreciate, you know, the political complexity of this on top of what you said before, which is that in the case of al-Bashir, we're dealing with a head of state to just add to the mix of things. So do you think, Jennifer, that this is going to sort of, we're sort of learning as we go along with this, or do you think that this is a problem with what Kenya did and what Chad did in terms of challenging the perceived legitimacy of the International Criminal Court? Because a lot of people who have said that this sort of undermines the power of the court. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't agree with that. I find, because also for me, working day by day at the court, and I see the strength of the cooperation of states like Chad and like Kenya, that have made aspects of the investigation possible that would not have been possible before. And I've seen how far they have stretched their political and other resources to make that cooperation possible. And I think, again, that like the issue of Bashir traveling to Kenya and to Chad poses a challenge, but I do believe that these states and that the international community of states that have supported the ICC are up to the challenge. And I think increasingly we see that Bashir is marginalized, and, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, this was never something he ever dreamed of that he would have to worry about. And now, you know, okay, he's traveled to Chad and Kenya, but, you know, since the arrest warrant in 2009 and even since our request in 2008, he's done very, very little travel and under very circumscribed circumstances. He's very limited in what he can do, and there's a lot of pressure as well domestically, you know. This is something that he has to manage, but it's never something he had to deal with before. So I think with, you know, of course, with those who have been arrested in other situations who are before the court, it's clear where their path has led them. But you can see for Bashir that the options are very much narrowing, and the fact that he has all the resources of a head of state to put at his disposal to put towards solving this problem that he faces, and that still he's very much marginalized and controlled in what he can do, I think shows the power of the court, and that, again, it's only a matter of time before he'll be in The Hague, before the circumstances make that possible.
I hope that's the case. Well, we have a clip that we're going to, I guess, ask you about afterwards and kind of have our reactions on concerning genocide, and it's a clip from...
This is a clip, actually, from Francis Deng, who is the Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide at the United Nations. And in this clip, which is actually a clip from a larger speech that he gave at the Brookings Institute, he's criticizing the labeling of what happened and is happening in Darfur as a genocide. I'm just setting up the clip, and he, just to give you an idea of his approach, is that instead of his claim is basically we have this really emotional reaction to the word genocide that sort of makes our head spin and we can't really think clearly. And so instead of using that word genocide, which is so emotionally charged, let's reframe what's going on as a conflict of identity. So this is the clip, and then Jennifer, we're going to ask you to comment on it. It's about a minute and a half long.
When we think of the kinds of genocides that are now recognized as genocide, they are all after the fact. They're all in historical hindsight. You say, yes, it was genocide. When it is happening, even when some people would begin to see it as genocide, there's a tendency for us to deny it. And we can debate, is it genocide or is it not? I believe very strongly that if we had seen Darfur as just the latest in a series of regional conflicts that began in southern Sudan and began to move north, to Nuba Mountains, to southern Blue Nile, to Bijar. If we had seen Darfur as the latest in a series of regional conflicts which have common causes, often expressed in one word, marginalization, by the center of the periphery, whose identities are also different from the center, we would have engaged Sudan in a constructive dialogue about how to deal with Darfur. Instead, the G word was thrown up there. The debate, is it genocide or is it not? If it is genocide, what do we do? The United States said it's genocide, but we're not going to do anything different. The UN said it's not genocide, but crimes are being committed that are not any less heinous than genocide. And Khartoum becomes defensive. And the whole thing becomes, therefore, being seen in isolation of what was happening in the whole Sudan.
Right, so that was Francis Deng, Special Advisor for the Prevention of Genocide, and he basically says we use the, as he puts it, G word in describing Darfur, and that was unfortunate not only because it prevented, quote, constructive dialogue, but also because it drew attention to Darfur at the expense of Sudan as a whole. And so, Jennifer, what is your reaction to that clip?
Well, I have a number of thoughts come to mind, and the first thought is, because I work for an international court, I work for a criminal court, I work for the Office of the Prosecutor, and we don't use terms lightly. You know, we don't use crimes against humanity or war crimes or genocide lightly. Our mandate is to investigate these crimes, to find the evidence, and if we find the evidence, as a lawyer, you have to put the proper name of the crime to the evidence. You can't shy away from that. You can't look away from that because it may be politically difficult. And I agree with him that crimes against humanity or war crimes are just as serious as genocide. But if we have evidence of genocide, then we have to put the name to the crime. And I think that's where you may have a distinction between the role of an international criminal court that has the mandate and the resources to do that investigation and to put the evidence forward and to put the name to the crime, as opposed to more general discussion that may raise a question but not be able to answer it. Finally, it's for the judges to determine, but that's why we need Ahmad Haroun and President al-Bashir in The Hague. I am very familiar. I've worked on the Sudan, on Darfur, for about 5 years. So, of course, Francis Deng is much more experienced in the field of the Sudan than I am. But I am familiar with discussion about root causes. I'm familiar with the African Union's excellent report by President Mbeki talking about marginalization of Darfuris and others in Sudan. But what our evidence has shown, separate and perhaps parallel to these issues, is that the government of the Sudan has executed a very deliberate policy to target civilians. So it's not just about whether there was conflict in Darfur. We all know there's conflict. We all know there are rebel groups. But that the response of the government was to punish the civilians in a systematic and a deliberate way. And that has to be part of the discussion, because that doesn't happen by accident. And it may not be an easy discussion to have with Khartoum, but if you leave that out of the equation, I don't think you're ever really going to find a solution, because, again, the point is to change the behavior, and that kind of policy has to be put to an end. It's not an acceptable response or to root causes. In fact, Ahmad Hamdan was quoted and was well known for having said that if the rebels among the civilian population are like fish in the water, to get the fish, you have to drain the water. And he made it very clear that the policy was ethnic cleansing, the policy was discrimination, and, as our evidence has shown, genocide. So that has to be part of the discussion. It's not easy to confront a regime that's committing crimes like that, but if you don't acknowledge them, they're not going to go away. I think the problem will just disperse. So.
Well, I think we all agree. I didn't hear you say this exactly, Jennifer, but I think you'd probably agree that the word genocide carries a much more pejorative connotation than does, like, crimes against humanity or civil war. I mean, would you agree with that?
I think there is a kind of historical connotation, a historical sense of the word genocide that has resonance. But for me as a lawyer, it's not more serious than extermination as a crime against humanity. And I believe that, you know, the crimes are well defined, their elements are well defined, and if the evidence is there for the crimes, you have to give them their proper name. And I think the same actually for a crime like rape, which could be considered quite a commonplace crime. It's a war crime. It's also a crime against humanity. It's also genocide, depending on the context. But for the individual victim who experiences it, it is not a commonplace crime. And we have in each case where we try to put the proper name to the crime so we can find a proper solution for ending the crime.
Oh, no, I absolutely understand your point that, look, we found evidence that this is what happened here, hence charges were filed. I totally get that. I guess I'm sort of just playing devil's advocate a little bit. This is a concept that's mentioned several times in the film The Reckoning and a position that's taken by the representative of Sudan to the UN. He says something to the effect of, look, you know, what's happening in the Sudan here is really not much different than a civil war. And, you know, at an international level, most of you are not concerned with civil war. But all of a sudden, you know, people want to label this a genocide to, like, sort of incite panic or incite sympathy or something to this effect. And his point, you know, which I think is clearly a defensive point, you know, I'm not giving it any legitimacy, I'm just sort of entertaining it. His point is like, look, you know, people are misconstruing the issues here in order to, like, gain political holding, I guess. So I take it you'd respond to that by saying it's nonsense.
Well, I can only speak from the perspective of the International Criminal Court and in particular the Office of the Prosecutor. We have to follow the evidence. If the evidence of genocide is there, then we have to name the crime by its proper name. And in fact, you have the Genocide Convention, which is almost universally ratified, in fact, probably universally ratified by all states. So the fact is that states have accepted through the Genocide Convention and also through the Rome Statute that genocide is a serious problem. It doesn't happen every time, but where you have the evidence, you have to address the problem on its face. You can't. It doesn't help to give it another name. I mean, but for me, as I said, crimes against humanity is a serious issue. War crimes are a serious issue. You have to address these as well, and you have to give the proper name to the crime according to the evidence.
Yeah, and I just want to say that one thing that frustrates me is I've seen more than once, and maybe Jennifer, you've seen it also, when the ICC is described by the media, not just the media in the U.S., but the international media as well, it's described as a war crimes court. Have you seen that description?
It is a kind of shorthand, yes, I've seen that.
And I just think that's very, very misleading because, as you're pointing out, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide are very different legal crimes, not to mention the crime of aggression, which we won't go into. But moving on to the other part of the show, we wanted to talk about this upcoming UN meeting, which is this Friday, I believe. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's on Friday.
Okay, and this is, can you just describe what this meeting is and who will be there?
Of course. Well, the UN Secretary General has decided to convene a high-level meeting in the course of the UN General Debate, which brings ministers of foreign affairs and heads of state from all over the world. And the purpose of the meeting is to talk about the Sudan in general. So they're looking at the referendum, looking at issues relating to the referendum. They're looking at Darfur and even a little bit at Eastern Sudan. So this is the goal, and what we understand is that they're hoping to reaffirm, again, commitments of the parties to implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. But what we have been trying to highlight and what we feel is very important is that justice is part of the comprehensive solution for the Sudan. And as the Secretary General himself has said, peace and justice must go hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. So that the participants in the meeting recognize that there are issues that need to be resolved on the side of justice and that this has to be part of the solution is important for this coming meeting.
Okay. Actually, I'm sure that there's a lot of our listeners who don't know what the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is or what we're talking about with the referendum. So for that, I'm going to play actually a clip. It's about a 4.5-minute clip, and then when it's over, we will ask you about the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. So this is about 4.5 minutes, and it is on this referendum that Jennifer mentioned.
Now, in January, Southern Sudan will determine whether it will remain a part of Sudan. But officials from the United Nations and the African Union caution that despite progress and even optimism, the peace process is threatened by a recent surge of violence in Darfur. VOA's Mariama Diallo reports.
In about 7 months, Southern Sudan will decide whether to secede from the rest of the country. This will be done through a referendum, a key part of the 2005 peace deal that ended Sudan's North-South civil war. In a recent visit to Washington, officials from the African Union and the United Nations assured the U.S. government they are working very hard to make sure the process leading to the January vote is smooth. But challenges still remain, according to former South African President Thabo Mbeki, who heads the African Union High-Level Implementation Panel on Sudan.
There's a challenge of the resolution of the conflict in Darfur. Then secondly, of course, there is the issue of the implementation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, or the message that we get from the principal political parties is indeed that everybody needs to keep to the agreement. The referendum must take place in January, as agreed, and that the outcome of that referendum needs to be respected.
Haile Menkerios, the United Nations representative to Sudan, says it's important for the outcome to be credible in order to assure legitimacy.
We do understand that we have to redouble the level of our engagement, of our support, much more from that of the elections. It is absolutely important that the process of the referendum avoids some of the discrepancies that were, seen during the elections.
Menkerios also says it is still possible to advocate for unity, but that should come with a dose of reality.
The best way to make unity attractive, I believe, is to make a separation possible. Do not then take separation to mean a complete divorce. The two parties to continue to work to see what is in their mutual benefit.
While visiting Kenya a few weeks ago, U.S. Vice President Joseph Biden met with Southern Sudan's first elected president, Salva Kiir. Mr. Biden insisted the process leading to the referendum must be peaceful and called on the international community for help. Norway, a large oil and gas producer, will offer advice and technical expertise to Sudan about how to share oil revenues if the referendum passes. Its foreign minister, Jonas Gahr Støre, recently visited the area.
If oil is approached from that perspective of how you can maximize income, maximize wealth creation, maximize technological progress, maximize infrastructure efficiency, well then the people of Sudan in the north and in the south stand to benefit. And we need to, or we will, you know, provide the evidence why we believe that's possible. Then it's for the parties to choose.
That optimism was somewhat countered by the UN and AU's representative in Darfur, Ibrahim Gambari, who warned the Security Council that violence has been escalating in parts of Darfur. He said nearly 450 deaths were recorded in May alone.
It saddens me to inform you that the fighting between the two belligerent parties is still continuing, and the security situation in parts of Darfur remains tense and volatile.
Despite all the challenges and the shortage of time, the situation is hopeful, says Thabo Mbeki. He adds that the political leadership in Sudan does understand its responsibilities in making sure that the issues of common interest for all Sudanese, north and south, are identified, addressed, and achieved. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Okay, that was a clip. Actually, if you want to watch the clip, it's on our Shore Resources page, fxtalk.cnish.edu, under Shore Resources, and it's from 2010. And so I think, you know, this clip and Jennifer, what we were talking about with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, it does relate to that one clip that we played from Francis Deng, in which he said, you know, labeling Darfur as a genocide was done at the expense of the rest of Sudan. And so, in fact, can you explain what the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is and the conflict out of which that agreement arose?
Sure. In fact, I work on Darfur. I'm familiar with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. It's not something that's within the mandate of the International Criminal Court. But, of course, the Comprehensive Peace Agreement is the agreement that ended the conflict between the north and the south of Sudan, which was concluded in 2005.
Mm-hmm. And was this conflict mainly about, what was this at the root of this conflict, do you know?
I would refer you to others who have focused on this more directly, but for example, the report, again, of the African Union written by President Mbeki, he was the chair of the AU high-level panel addressing Darfur. In fact, he looked at the issue of marginalization throughout the Sudan, a marginalization of the peripheries by the center, and how he has, and they have tried to show that this has fueled conflict throughout the Sudan, including between the north and the south. So I think his report on that is something quite useful as a reference and a resource.
Okay, great. And so at this UN meeting on Friday, they will be discussing whether or not, because our research shows that this referendum and the speed at which the logistical preparations are progressing is, you know, suboptimal, that there seems to be, you know, some foot dragging and so forth, and there's a worry that this referendum will not happen. Is that correct?
I have heard the same. It's not something that I follow directly, but I've heard that, yes.
Okay. And so this will be the importance of this referendum going forward will be something that is addressed at this meeting on Friday.
Yes, as I understand, the participants are hoping to reaffirm the commitment for the referendum to happen on time.
Mm-hmm. And so what you were saying before is that insofar as your office and the ICC is concerned, you see the action and the arrest and the legal handling of the Darfur issue as crucial to this peace agreement?
Well, in fact, yes. And again, I would refer at the risk of sounding like a broken record, I would refer to the report overseen by President Mbeki, because what he highlights is what a lot of experts have said, is that everything in Sudan is interconnected. So while we have a mandate for Darfur, to investigate in Darfur, we do feel we have a responsibility to highlight that connection. For example, Ahmed Haroun is now currently the governor of South Kordofan, which is a very crucial state in this process of implementing the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, and where we have seen violence of the type we had in Darfur breaking out in the area of Abyei, which is disputed, which is of interest to both sides because of resources and oil and other reasons. And our obligation is really to point out this is an individual who is wanted for 51 counts of crimes against humanity and war crimes, and for organizing massive campaigns against civilians in order to achieve government policy. He did that in Darfur. Experts on the South talk about the role that he played before in South Kordofan, and he's there again. So we acknowledge, of course, you know, that the diplomats have a very complex portfolio to manage. But what we're giving them is information and a kind of leverage to say, how do you draw a red line? How do you say that certain activities like organizing militias to attack civilians are not acceptable? How do you try to rule that out? And if you can manage to rule that out, it will make the process of implementing the CPA much more straightforward and simpler, because you're ruling out a major cause of instability and insecurity when you try to eliminate that kind of violence.
And I've heard that also that President Obama will be at this meeting. Is that your understanding?
Yes, he will. He has. They have confirmed. The U.S. has confirmed that he will participate.
Okay. And can you just, before we switch gears from the UN meeting to something else, because I'm sure that our listeners are not familiar with the change, subtle perhaps, maybe not so subtle, between the Bush administration's stance towards the International Criminal Court and the Obama administration's. And I was just wondering if you could make some comments on what has changed with Obama.
Well, for the Office of the Prosecutor and for the court, the most important thing is ongoing engagement. And we have that engagement with non-state parties such as the U.S. as well as with state parties. President Bush was very strong on the Sudan issue, and we believe that his insistence and consistency on the Sudan issue is part of why we have a comprehensive peace agreement, because he put a high level of pressure and kept that pressure up on Khartoum to end the war in the south and to come to an amicable agreement. He made the issue of Darfur a very high priority one for his upcoming administration, that it was not acceptable to stand by and to watch things happen. So it's very important that his speech on the 24th really reinforced that message that crimes cannot be allowed to continue. But that ongoing engagement with the U.S. government, Bush to Obama, is something that we continue to work on.
All right, we're going to kind of switch gears here. I don't know if you've ever gotten a question like this, considering the nature of the crimes that are really investigated by the ICC, but I was just curious if you could speak on if motive comes into account at all when determining these types of crimes, like why did so-and-so do such-and-such? And I know with genocide, you know, it being, directly focused with some ethnic group, that it could just be some sort of hate thing, but I was wondering if it goes any deeper than that, or is it just basically look for the evidence, see the crime, and that's it?
No, I think in understanding why crimes happen, that's part of the picture in investigating a crime. I mean, you have to show for the elements of the crime, you have to show the specific intent to commit the crime, and you have to show the act of committing the crime. But understanding the motive, understanding why the crime is being committed, is also part of the process. I think it reminds me of something that I read from Primo Levi, who had written that, who is a Holocaust survivor, who had written, there's no such thing as useless violence. And I think often you find that as irrational or horrible as a crime may seem, it's committed for a purpose. In the case of the Sudan, for the investigation we're doing, it's to further a particular policy or to achieve a certain policy goal. But it's usually for a purpose. The purpose may not be understandable to everyone, but that's important to understand as well when you're looking at crime.
Okay, well, speaking of the situation on Darfur, I don't know if you slightly mentioned it there at the end, but what kind of motive is behind the genocide of President al-Bashir?
Well, we set this out in our application for the arrest warrant, which is public as well and which can be found on our website. But what we show, and it builds again a little bit on the African Union's report, you have an underlying basis of marginalization of groups on the periphery, and Darfur is almost as peripheral as you can get in the Sudan. And in fact, when you had the rebel movements coming up in 2002, 2003 in Darfur, the government response was that the ethnic groups, the tribes that were perceived as somehow their sons were rebels, their sons were in these movements, that they had to be punished. And in fact, they were a threat and they were therefore targeted for elimination. For genocide, you have to show the specific intent to destroy the group in whole or in part. So that was part of the investigation to show that intent.
If I can sort of continue the same line of thought, so what you're telling us is that, at least this is one of the things I hear you saying, is that groups like the Janjaweed are targeting ethnic groups which typically support rebels, right? That's sort of like the goal here is to like put down the insurgency, sort of?
Well, the message to the poor, the Masalit, the Zagawa is, your sons are among the rebels, therefore you as tribes can be targeted as a whole. In fact, that your tribes, in the most general sense, have generated this threat, and therefore the tribes should be eliminated.
So sort of like annihilate this group as a whole for the sake of this problem that some of them are causing?
Well, in fact, Ahmad Haroon made a trip to Darfur toward the beginning of the conflict, and he was received by some of the elders of the Fur tribe who were targeted. And they expressed joy to see him. We're so glad that you're here. We're being targeted. We're being attacked. And his message to them was, you are the enemy. You don't understand. You are the enemy, and you will be destroyed. And the Minister of Defense at the same time said that if there is a single rebel in a village, the entire village may be destroyed.
So there's sort of this attitude of expendability for human life.
Go ahead.
You already answered this for me, but I guess the question I was asking myself is, you know, even if rebel groups are living in these particular villages, or as you mentioned, the sons of your tribes are typically rebels, even if that is the case, I was trying to piece together why Sudan, the government, would have an interest in preventing humanitarian aid to these people once they've been displaced. Because I just couldn't think of a logical reason. Why still kill people or prevent them from receiving food, shelter, medical care when they're not in a position to harm you anymore? It just wasn't clear to me. But I think what I hear you saying is that even though, you know, these people couldn't really be a threat to Sudan anymore, whether they are or not I think is arguable, but I can't conceive a way they could still be a threatened displacement camp. I sort of hear you saying there's still like this hate or this stigma for these peoples, even though they really pose no more threat. Mm-hmm. Or is there some other way you could explain the Sudan's sort of interference with humanitarian aid?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think there are separate questions here, whether the civilians are a threat or whether they are perceived as a threat. I mean, of course, it's against the law to attack civilians, but they may still be perceived as a threat. And in fact, they were perceived as threats even in the displaced camps, even when their villages were burned down, because they were seen still as somehow responsible for the rebellion. So what we have seen with the hindering of humanitarian aid, and in fact the same thing was happening in Bosnia during the conflict there, that it is a kind of continuation of the crime, a continuation of a kind of extermination or genocide by attrition. And it's a mode that can be taken up when there is greater attention from the international community, because it's easier somehow to cover up, to say, well, of course aid can get hindered, things can get stuck, you know, just like the excuse of red tape. But when you look at the evidence and you look at the information, you see that it's deliberate and it's a continuation of the policy to target the civilians by other means.
You might even say that this continued aggression towards displaced civilians might almost be evidence of the genocide, that, look, you know, these people are no longer a threat, but clearly you're still treating them as such.
Exactly. And this is something as well that the UN Commission of Inquiry had highlighted, that if ethnic cleansing takes place and people go to displaced camps, but they are taken care of in displaced camps, you don't say it's genocide. But if they go to the camps and they are continually targeted in the camps, then it's not just ethnic cleansing, it's something more.
And so I just want to go back to, given this discussion and this, you know, it's almost like this habitual aggression towards this group, regardless of whether they are actually a threat. And I'm going back to that clip by Francis Deng, where he used the phrase, you know, constructive dialogue rather than labeling this genocide. And he actually said, even while the genocide, the G word, is going on, you know, we should refrain from labeling it as such. And so do you think that this emphasis on constructive dialogue could be the kind of thing that could stop this sort of habitual aggression that we're talking about, or do you think that's just very idealistic?
I understand the purpose of dialogue, and this is the role of the diplomat, and it's important that it continue. But for me, I work for an international court, and there is an international consensus, and it's represented by the Rome Statute, that international crimes cannot go unaddressed and unpunished. So in our experience, and I think you can find as well in the experience of the previous ad hoc tribunals, the ICCY, ICPR, there's no benefit to ignoring the crime. Confronting them is difficult because it's not something easily done through diplomatic conversations. It's not a subject that's easily addressed. It's not something that's happening by accident. Diplomats have to sit with government officials who will be aware of what the policy is and why it's being conducted and how it's being conducted. So it's not an easy conversation to have. But again, there is an international consensus behind the Rome Statute, behind addressing these crimes. And I think that the push for justice can go hand in hand with other efforts to bring about peaceful resolution to underlying disputes or to try to address other aspects of the conflict. But without that focus as well on justice, then there's just some crucial piece of the picture that's always going to be missing.
Right. So some time ago we talked about this, and I'm sure you're familiar with this debate between peace versus justice and, you know, demanding justice in this sense, in what you're talking about, which is addressing this as a legal crime and holding the wrongdoers accountable and so forth, actually disrupts the peace process. And this has been a claim that's been made by several people. And so you disagree with that. And what I hear you saying is that, no, actually, to really get to peace, justice has to be a part of it. So does dialogue, but it can't be dialogue without justice once these crimes that have been identified through evidence gathering and whatnot have been identified, then we cannot ignore that. That would actually just make it worse.
Yeah, I think the Sudan is a good example of the maxim that the history that we ignore, we are condemned to repeat. It's not, as I said, it's not easy to address crimes that are organized on this level or to address these policies. But when it comes to the peace table, the role of justice is an important tool that mediators are learning how to use. And I think if you look at Yugoslavia, would you have had a peace agreement there if Karadzic and Mladic were at the table? They were excluded because they were indicted. Would you have had a peaceful situation returned to Liberia if Charles Taylor had stayed? So these are important examples as well. It doesn't necessarily make it easier. I mean, when you have a situation come to this point and these kinds of crimes, it's not easy to address, but there are tools that can be used that can help justice to play its rightful role in the comprehensive approach.
All right. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time here, but I know at least for me, you've definitely shed some light on the conflict in Darfur things I didn't understand before.
Likewise, thank you.
We definitely appreciate your time here. We know you're busy and strapped, and you've been a fantastic guest.
Yeah, and maybe after the meeting, you could come back and inform us about whether the Office of the Prosecutor was happy with that meeting, and the challenges that it now faces after that meeting.
I would be happy to do so. Thank you for having me.
Okay. You've been listening to Ethics Talk, and check out our show resources page and also the report, Jennifer, that you mentioned from President Mbeki. We will put that on our show resources page as well. And thank you once again, and this is Ethics Talk. Good night.
Thank you.